Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Welcome. I'm so delighted you're joining me this evening because we are going to be talking about what I consider magic. And what is that magic? It is dance. It is music. It is being in touch with the self and becoming aware of what I would call the greater you. This evening, we have the privilege of talking Banana Chef Sayad. Dance of Oneness is the title of her book. It's a gorgeous cover. It's a picture of her in a split moment of one of her performances. And she is a woman who absolutely has a passion for music and for dance and what she has learned through that, not just a professional environment, but the mental, emotional, spiritual, physical aspect of what she grew into is quite a story. And she is Iranian. She is called a spiritual embodiment teacher, a sacred dancer. And she actually founded an organization called the Dance of Oneness. Welcome. I want to say I just think you are an incredible human being. Your passion for the arts is just inspiring. It really is. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you this evening. Thank you for that introduction.
The very first thing that my eyes connected with is the dedication to the body, the temple where the infinite dances. This is a phenomenal story. You are in this aspect of history that, you have lived an aspect of history that is filled with a tragedy, and yet at the same time, the very essence of the history of your people, of your country, of its culture, it's empowering. So you have this seemingly divided, almost polarization that could be expected. Give my audience a little bit of your background and how it was that you and your family ended up coming into the United States.
Yes. So I was born before the Islamic takeover of Iran. I was born during the time of the Shah of Iran, the King of Iran, Mohammad Reza Shah. And many refer to this time as part of the golden age where, Iran, living in Tehran for sure, felt like you were in a country where, in an environment that was a blend of the European flair and the Eastern depth and mystery and beauty. So very much, very similar to what you would experience in Istanbul, for example, a kind of an environment where different religions, different cultures, different genders and gender orientations were all coexisting in a harmonious way. Of course, there was also political upheaval to a degree, but nothing compared to what we came to experience after the 1979 takeover. I myself was always dancing. I had a passion for dance for as far back as I can remember, and a passion for the divine. So these two passions fused together. They came together as one flame over time, and my dancing became a way of communing with the divine and also expressing the divinity, the divine energy, the existence of the invisible realm into the world. But as I was growing up and very passionate about dance, I wasn't really sent to dance school. My parents didn't see that I would get dance training, even though I come from a long lineage of performing artists. My father is a very famous Iranian director, film director, theater director, actor, and writer. He's like a legend in his own time. And he and my mother both didn't think, oh, maybe this girl who is so passionate about dance should be trained. And this is because in the Islamic view, dance is considered subversive and morally corrupting. Even though my parents are not religious, this was sort of infiltrated into the collective unconscious, this idea that dance is not a high art form, that it is somehow something that you wouldn't really devote yourself to in a real or serious way. But I nevertheless pursued my passion and trained myself was interested in really creating this capacity for my body to express what I was feeling inside. And even though I wasn't trained by anybody, I sort of knew what to do in a way to be able to build my body and make myself capable of expressing what I felt in my heart. We had to leave Iran. We left a little bit before the Islamic takeover, but then returned. And after the regime was in place, the Islamic Republic, it was very clear that we could not live there. And so we moved to the United States and applied for political asylum and basically became asylees in the United States.
With this background, no matter where you went, the love of dance was there. And your father, he was really not able to find work. And so you and your sister and your mother were sent back to Iran, were you not?
Yes, he stayed in the United States because basically going back for him would have been quite dangerous because he was a political artist. His art has socio-political dimensions, and so for him to go back would have been dangerous. He got word that he would meet with a lot of resistance if he goes back, and his films and his theater were confiscated by the new regime. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't wise for him to go back. And yes, because there was no source of income. My sister and I, with my mother, we returned. We went back to Iran during the this current regime and basically experienced a lot of what now has become more visible to the world. Given the situation in Iran, we had to endure a lot of the restrictions and the basically the repression of women.
Mm-hmm.
Among others.
Your grandmother, she sounded, when you wrote about her, and you said she was just dearly beloved by you, Bartul Abidjan Salimi, and please, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but she was such a loving person, and you really missed her when you all had to leave. But I was fascinated what you said about your dad, and you've just made a comment, but in your book you said he was a creative maverick, he rejected dogma and risked everything for his values, and he refused the oppressive shackles of ideology, and he never compromised his principles for fame, status, wealth, political power, or even his own safety. And when I was reading your story, I thought you were very much like your father. The values that he upheld, that he lived, that he walked every day, actually, you were a mirror of him in many respects. You had to do it in your own way, but this is how you felt about dance and about what meant so much to you, because the oppressiveness, one of the things that you describe that I think is so significant to anybody that would read your book, Dance of Oneness, is how, as an individual, the ideologies, the dogmas, the brutality, the horrible, horrible suppression of women that was done, and this affects the men as well, but with the women, you couldn't do anything. You were under constant threat. And yeah, that's an awful way to live. And you also saw the hypocrisy of so-called belief systems. And then there's your wonderful grandmother who espoused certain aspects of belief systems that were just totally, totally wonderful. She was nothing like what was being put upon in the way of oppression of the average person. And this, yeah, this to me is so pronounced and so very significant that I think when people read it, they'll go, wow, I wonder if I could have had that much of a thought process regarding this. But you ended up just continuing the dance, and Rumi is someone who is known around the world for his writings and his wisdom, and you found deep comfort in his writings. And you had to eventually leave, as you say, leave Iran forever in your heart because of what you witnessed and what you experienced. That's a very heavy situation, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I had to leave Iran, but Iran has never left my heart. So, you know, with what is happening today, where, you know, we have the war on the one hand, which is in ceasefire right now, but really also the war that this government has waged on the people for the last 47 years, really from the time they came to power. People have been held hostage. They've been under assault. And those of us who had to leave, forced to leave, really, none of us really wanted to leave, but we saw that there was no other way for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who stayed, all of us equally under assault, under a lot of oppression by the regime. And now that things are becoming more and more visible, now that the veil has been, you know, lifted to a great degree over, you know, the actions of the regime and the ongoings, you know, inside the country, I'm very hopeful that we can shift to a different way, shift to a new system that the people will elect, that the people would vote for. Both the people inside Iran and the people, the Iranians who were forced to leave, all of us together, really electing the kind of government and the kind of leadership that can serve. And once we do that, that kind of government will also contribute so positively to the world, whereas the current regime has been nothing but detriment to the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And sometimes it's very hard to believe that people would treat their own, using a simplistic statement, why would they be so brutal? Why would they be so cruel to those that are their own people? Well, there's a lot more to the story than most of us even are aware of. And I think your book brings a lot of that information to the front of where it needs to be seen. Now, you yourself, you have such an honesty in your story about how sacred dance evolved you as an individual, as a woman, and your various explorations. And you call up the information about the divine feminine role models. And in the process of going through this evolution due to dance and music and your faith, you found that you had your own patriarchal biases. And this really is what I call growing up, becoming aware of how there's been an indoctrination that without realizing you had accepted. And in dance, there's tremendous competition. There is a lot of what I would say pettiness, jealousy, and you mention this in the book. And it's something that you were so good at dancing, because for you, when you danced, you were dancing for the divine. You were dancing for the sacred feminine. You were dancing for the love and joy of what it gave you. And for you to decide to evolve into the flamenco, I mean, that music alone is vitally intense and very stirring, and it's to dance to it, to be able to really dance to it and dance to it well. That is something you just seem to express so very, very well. It just opened you up to a part of yourself that you really didn't have a clue about. Am I right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, when I saw flamenco for the first time, and this was on film, I saw Carmen by Carlos Saura, the Spanish filmmaker, and it was like I was bitten somehow. I was just I became completely obsessed. But the interesting thing was that I felt that I knew this form. It was so familiar to me. I felt like that I had done it always, that I had danced this style always. But it appealed to me so much precisely because of its strength and ferocity. I myself had just we had moved from Iran, maybe it had been a couple years. And I really didn't know what to do with my anger and my grief of leaving my homeland and my friends and relatives, especially my grandmother, but also the anger of having to do that, anger at this regime and their system, their belief system, their faith that I really questioned whether it was true. So all of the anger and grief for a young teenager was just too much for me, and I didn't feel like there was anywhere I could look to for solace in a way, because even my parents and the Iranian community that was in diaspora, all the people who had been forced to leave, everyone was under pressure. Everyone was in a state of limbo, not knowing whether we would be able to go back soon, what we were supposed to do, what was going to be people's source of income in this new environment. So there was really nowhere to turn to. And when I found flamenco, I felt I had a source that I could connect with. For me, I had always in my heart a connection with the divine, but didn't know how to deal with my grief and anger via this connection. And flamenco gave me the tools to be able to express these emotions without fear or without a worry that maybe they're not good, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. It gave me the tools to express these emotions and be able to transmute them, be able to transform them into something creative and in the end joyful, which is the, you know, the arc of a flamenco piece. It starts with contraction, perhaps anger or grief, and then it moves through that emotion, expresses it, and ends in joy and just sheer aliveness.
The music is powerful, very powerful.
Yeah.
And then to watch the dancers, it's really something, and it usually will take years of training. But as you said, you felt like you had danced it before. You were introduced to it, and a dancer, you're dancing every day. You have to take care of your body. You really have to do what is necessary to keep yourself in shape and to stay flexible and supple. And you say that flamenco is a dance of fire, and I can totally empathize with that description. And you said you have to come in touch with yourself, and the flamenco teaches one to dance the fine line between too much fire, which can burn us and others, and too little fire, which leaves everyone frozen, lifeless, and disengaged. And I thought that was a very powerful description of a dance that really does, when people are listening to it, you can see in their body language, when they're watching the dancers, when they are listening to the music, you cannot not be affected by it. It's that powerful. Mm-hmm. It is that powerful.
Yes. And therefore, you learn to be a keeper of the flame, a guardian of the flame, so to speak, and careful about tending the flame, right, so that it's not too burning too highly, or if it's underlit, basically. So being able to tend the flame so that it's just right. And I want to also say that you can look at different art forms, especially when it comes to music and dance, and observe what elements they really enliven in us or activate in us. And some forms, like Persian dance, for example, is much more airy and watery in quality. It's both very ethereal and very sensual, and the movements are very circular. But something like flamenco that has a lot of passion and there's a lot of explosive movement is definitely fiery, but also it also has earth, the earth elements, because it's a very grounded form.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Then with the flamenco, you actually walked away from it. You were highly regarded as a performer, and you literally burned yourself out. I'll use your words. And I really think that as a dancer, it just opened you up to yourself in a whole new way. And then you found Tai Chi, which in my view has always been like a ballet. Very, 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 very classical in movement, very smooth, no jerks, no rush, just a flow. And I've always been in awe of that and have done a little bit of it myself. But you say Tai Chi is like the way of water. And I thought, yes, that is very, very true. And when you became acquainted with Tai Chi, you actually went in for classes, and the person that was teaching the classes, after a bit of time, he just used one word to you: relax.
Yes.
Relax. Well, after flamenco.
Relax.
Oh, you know, after the flamenco, then all of that energy, all of that passion, all of that, that's just very grounded, very real, very sensuous. And then to find that you're told to relax. That, that's quite a contrast.
Yes, and I needed that. I needed that contrast. I needed to find more balance. I was too fiery. And I needed this other side, this yin side, this sort of faceless, formless dimension that Tai Chi brings us into. Tai Chi, you know, I feel it is the undercurrent of all movement. It's sort of the ground of movement, this undifferentiated motion. And it was a real solace for me. I felt really embraced by the environment. As I practiced Tai Chi outside, I felt embraced by nature. I needed that embrace. I had been so fiery and so focused on my own expression, that I needed to remember the greater again. I needed to remember the invisible and the oneness. And Tai Chi was my way. Tai Chi became my guide to that.
Rumi, you have so many of his statements throughout your book, and I can understand. He was a very wise man. You have one of his quotes: "Learn the alchemy true human beings know. The moment you accept what troubles you've been given, the door will open, because what hurts you blesses you." That last line, "what hurts you blesses you." The depth of that wisdom. Most people, including myself at one time in my life, would have said, "What hurts me blesses me? Really? Are you serious? I don't think so. I don't like being hurt. Why is it going to bless me?" It's only with wisdom that we understand those challenges that are given to us are meant to enable us to become bigger than what we see ourselves as. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's quite a paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I was speaking the other day about trauma, and a friend reminded me that trauma really is a gift in disguise, and to sort of be able to reframe the way we look at, you know, our pain and what hurts us as a teaching, as a guidance toward becoming more whole, becoming more compassionate, more empathetic to what others are going through, all of what makes us more mature, makes us more human. So in that sense, what hurts us blesses us, because it opens us, it shows us at the bigger picture of life, other than just what we know, what we've experienced, and what we think is life.
Mm-hmm.
So it expands us, if we allow it, of course. It is also possible that we may decide not to look at what hurts us as what blesses us, but simply as what hurts us, and complain and experience ourselves as a victim. It's our choice, right? It's a decision. But definitely that choice is there, that option is there to see that what hurts us blesses us. And I think it's something that, you know, I myself have to remember too, as I'm going through my day, as I hear the news of what is happening around the world and the injustices, to remember what is teaching here, how is this evolving us, because there is a divine plan, and if we believe in the divine plan, then it makes it very difficult to keep focusing on the day-to-day events and see them just as an end in themselves, you know, just the human affairs guided by the human mind. So the remembrance of the divine plan, I think, then helps us see that what hurts us blesses us.
You make a statement in your book, and I'm quoting directly, "If each of us carried a healthy, loving sense of self, there would be space for all of us to coexist and express our brilliance. Establishing our individual worth and greatness should not depend on proving that we are better than others." And I think that that is very, very deep wisdom. I think when we compete against ourselves, that is one thing. But to realize that if we want to be the best of what we can be, that's what we need to strive for. It's not competing against someone else. It's really competing against ourselves, asking ourselves, as you just mentioned, what can I learn from this? How can I be the best I possibly can be? What is it that I can change? What is it maybe I need to learn? There's just so many questions that we can ask ourselves that actually free us, as you found through your journey. And of course, your journey is a fascinating one. And you ended up being in a professional environment with your dancing, and you were breaking all kinds of rules of different ways of expressing yourself. And you even had a challenge trying to get musicians to play for you, Iranian musicians, because they had their biases that they had been indoctrinated with as far as working with women, etc. But they eventually changed their mind because they saw what you were doing. They said, you have developed something with dance and music that goes beyond what we have been aware of. Wow, that is really saying something.
Yeah, this was, you know, I had a vision in my heart and mind that I had not seen at all. I had a vision of mystical dance, mythic dance. And when I would speak about it, people would just say, we don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen anything like that. And this, I mean, in the Iranian culture, of course, the kinds of dances, the description I just mentioned, do exist, of course. Like Martha Graham was a choreographer who worked in this field of mythical dance. But that wasn't the case for the dance in my culture. So when I would speak about it, people didn't know what I was saying. And when I sought out musicians to collaborate with me, they didn't accept my invitation because dance in general, as I said earlier, doesn't have a good reputation in the Iranian culture because of the influence of Islam. So when I did present my first concert and did have musicians working with me who were convinced that this was going to be a beautiful thing, when we did present it, people were very surprised. They said, wow, I've never seen anything like it. This is beyond dance. And my response to them was that, no, this is dance. This is definitely dance. And dance is a high art. It's an exalted art form. It is definitely one of the earliest forms of communication for human beings, probably even predating language.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a sacred practice. Of course, over time, it became more of entertainment and it became something more devoid of spirit, let's say, and disconnected from its sacred roots. But once you awaken the sacred within dance, then people remember. People remember something primal. I'm always very gratified, I want to say, but also just every time it takes me by surprise that even when I don't explain what the dance is that people are about to watch, what my performance is, so many people receive the messages I was intending. They see what I was intending and what I was focused on,
mm-hmm.
even without me describing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very, very true. And combining music and the dance with it, and as you say, with your intention of what you're wanting to communicate with people, is very important. You bring out how dance has enabled you to overcome what you call deep resistance. And you said you had to be aware of the voices that were inside your head. And it was the indoctrination that was very, very deep within you. You say it's an old cellular imprint carried by women for generations, especially women from the Middle East. And what is one of those beliefs? A good woman ought to be silent, submissive, obedient. And mm-hmm. you said you had to overcome your own paralysis, not just for yourself, but for the women of the Middle East and for anyone who had ever felt stunted and unable to express themselves because they had lost touch with their soul. I think that is one of the biggest challenges anyone can go through, is to be aware of themselves and be very grateful that they have the freedom at any time to be the person that they really are. They don't have to wear a mask. They don't have to buy in to the biases and the old ways. But it does take a lot of work to be able, one, to recognize those biases that maybe you were taught that you did not know any differently. And it's deep in the subconscious. And that's where dance can really help to relieve. And you do teaching of dance. And Banafshe, I really think that you have accomplished so much with your dance of oneness process that you teach to people. I'm sure it's very, very rewarding and satisfying to you to be able to share what your life experience has brought forth and to be so engaged in the cultural environment. Your father and mother finally believed in you, where they, for so long they just thought this just isn't appropriate. But yet you personified so much of the wonderful qualities of your parents in your own way. That must have meant a lot to you when you were finally recognized by them and they, you might say, got rid of those cultural biases that had been so indoctrinated into their thinking as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. It's been very rewarding to have their support and to have them sort of applaud what I've been able to do. And I've been also able to really change the way Iranians view dance. I've been one of the people who was able to bring about this revolution in terms of how dance is viewed and experienced. And I'm very grateful for that, that I was given that opportunity to do that. And it gives me such joy to work with people in classes and workshops and retreats and see them, you know, come home to their body in a way that they had not experienced before. Because dance, especially sacred dance, offers us that opportunity to come into contact with our body and our soul in a way that can feel so much like a homecoming, something that we know deep inside and we start to remember. It's a joy to see people make that connection again, this return, regardless of their background in movement, regardless of their age, regardless of their gender. It's accessible to all of us. It's there for all of us to partake in, this dance of life, really. And to enter your life as a dance is the ultimate invitation, how to live like a dancer. Regardless of what, you know, regardless of whether you're a professional dancer or you've had any training at all.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Banafshe Sayad, I think your book is wonderful. And of course, we just barely scratched the surface of so much of what you share. But The Dance of Oneness is the title of your book, Embody Love and Luminosity to Transform Your Life. And your website is danceofoneness.org, danceofoneness.org. I just sincerely wish you the very best with your work, with your dance, with your teaching, and in producing this book that has so much in it relative to the development, not just of the awareness of dance and music, but the inner journey of self that you share with others, that you say you can have this as well. And I just think that is a wonderful gift to give to anyone, because I think so many are seeking and searching, and again, music and dance, two aspects that bring a lot of beauty into this world. I want to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Donna. I really enjoyed this conversation with you. It's been a wonderful journey. And thank you for reading my book so closely. It means a lot to me to have readers like you. And I appreciate what you're doing, and I wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and have a beautiful spring. This is Donna Sebo. We are saying goodbye to Banafshe Sayad, and I want to spell her name for you so that you have it. And that is B-A-N-A-F like Frank, S-H-E-H. Her last name, S like Sam, A-Y-Y-A-D. We are going to be shifting into something a little bit different, but oh, Dance of Oneness, what an amazing, an amazing publication from a woman whose family ended up having to leave because of danger and threat. And look at what's going on in Iran as we speak and how it is affecting the world overall. Times have changed, but sometimes those of the old guard do not want to let go of their grip of fear and power. But as history has shown many times, that power and that grip eventually comes to an end. Well, I want to say to those of you that are joining me for the first time, welcome. I'm delighted to have your company, and I hope that you will come and visit the program whenever it's comfortable for you. And to remember or to be aware of the fact that the Donna Sebo Show is every evening from 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time, and we have a sixth show that is done on Wednesdays, and that's Warriors for Peace. And that's a doubleheader. Every Wednesday is a doubleheader. So we've got a lot going on. And then, of course, the Donna Sebo television show and our 20th program on the brain trauma is now available for anybody to listen to. And later this month, I will be airing the audio portion of that television show so you can hear the audio side of it and my interview with Dr. Dan and then also Bruce Parkland. And we'll be discussing that at a later date. Also, don't forget, for those of you in the state of Washington, the BEPC semi-annual expo is coming up the 25th and 26th of this month. And I am going to be having a conversation with Lorelei Shamayo and also with Holly, who is a director, a chairperson of the BEPC organization. And so we're going to be talking about the upcoming event. You'll hear that conversation that will be coming up this next week. So I wanted to be sure that you were aware of that. Now, this event is that Saturday and Sunday. In the hours on Saturday are 11 to 5, Sunday 11 to 6, and then the hour before, 10 to 11, both Saturday and Sunday, is the Psychic Showcase. And there will be those of us that will be attending it. I also will be the MC for the Sunday morning meeting for the Psychic Showcase. So I will be there assisting people to understand what is really going on. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful event. I will be attending it as a vendor, also as a speaker. I will be doing a speaking engagement both on Saturday and Sunday. So how can you find out about what's going on? Well, what you do is go to the BEPCweb.org website. That's B like boy, E like Edward, P like Paul, C like Charles, web.org. And you go there and you're going to find out all the details about the speakers and the topics and the services and all kinds of things that are going to be going on. They anticipate 100, maybe more than 100 vendors that will be attending. So it's quite an event. And as I said, it is twice a year in the spring and in the fall. And each of the events are very, very unique in what is presented and the services and products that you will become aware of. And it's a family kind of an event. So that's great. And someone asked me about, gee, can I bring my dog or my cat or whatever? The only request is that we make sure that you have the animal on a leash, number one. Whether it's a dog, a cat, a ferret, I don't care if it's a parrot. You've got to have it on a leash of some way so that it just isn't suddenly going to get spooked and get away from you. That is not what we need. Also, you need to be aware that it's your responsibility to keep your animal, whatever we may have, that animal must be under your control at all times. And that's very, very important. So animals are not prohibited, but we do ask for a very strong consideration of the environment that you will be in and the people that will be there. And sometimes, you know, it's not easy. Sometimes people are allergic to animals. I mean, there's just all kinds of things going on. So just remember, just be wise with that. So I hope to see you there. And again, we're going to be having a conversation with the two ladies that are so deeply engaged and involved in making this event happen. And if you are an author and you would like to be featured on my radio or television program, what you need to do is get your publication to me, and I do not do PDFs. I will not do them. I get materials sometimes that are 400 pages thick. So it's very important you understand I have to have the actual book, and I also have to have your contact information so that I can be in touch with you. That's very, very important. So this is something that I really feel is a wonderful opportunity. And if you have the contact information, don't forget to put in a telephone number too, because often I get busy and sometimes it's easier for me just to pick up the phone and to call. And we connect calendars and pick a time for the interview. All of that being said, if the material is something that I can use for my programming. So that being said, we're going to move right along. And one of the things that I wanted to touch on this evening, because I came across a documentary. I really enjoy documentary programs, especially those that are showing how people are waking up to what needs to be done and how, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to viewing things that maybe haven't been around for thousands of years, and I'll explain why this was significant to me, I came across this video, and it was about Kent, England, southern England, and an experiment that was being done by environmentalists and a couple of groups that are affiliated with animal conservation, restoring areas of wild that are no longer wild. And there was this one area in England that had this seemingly very, very thick forest. If you were to have a drone go over it, or you were to fly over it in a plane, you would see this dense, dense canopy. And it looks just lush and beautiful, and it's wonderful. However, what was not being observed to the degree it should have been observed is that the forest was dying. And a wild forest is one that has so many different components to it. It has a number of literally thousands of life forms that are existing in it. And a canopy is not closed. A wild forest canopy is going to have open spaces, and that's where you get your wildlife and your wildflowers, and there's such a diversity that you will find. And the animals that occupy areas have a great deal to do with that. Now, here in the United States, many of the native peoples have come together and bringing back the buffalo. The buffalo, as we all know, was almost totally exterminated here in this country. There are horrific photographs, and I mean they're really horrific photographs, of piles of bones of bison, their skulls, that is so high, it's like a mountain. It's just a mountain of dead, you know, dead bison, their skeletons. And to think that people would even do that in our world today, we go, why would they do this? Well, humanity does some pretty stupid things. And if you look at humanity's history, you won't run out of a lot of material, believe me. We are finding more and more material about ourselves and our ancestors that make us just shake our head. But people often, even today, will say, oh, just poison this. We have it here in Washington. We have people that say, go out and destroy the coyotes. They just absolutely destroy them. Why? Why are you going to destroy them? We have created a lot of the problems that we experience, and we're not willing because of our lack of education many times and understanding that we have a responsibility to learn how to live alongside of nature. And nature is a part of us. And if we don't have nature around us, we don't do very well. We don't do well at all. So it's really a fascinating situation to live in a time when we are learning to not ignore what needs to be done. What I started to say is that Native Americans and many other people have wanted the bison brought back. And there's been a lot of argument about it. There's just been all kinds of dissension. But what has happened is that they've realized that there was a reason why the prairies were so rich with grasses and the buffalo traveled over thousands of miles. They were migrators. They would go from one area to another. And they did that with purpose. This is something their ancestors had done for a long time. Well, in England, they had had a bison, but it was a different type of bison. And 6,000 years ago, it had, it was slowly being just totally destroyed, the species. And by the time the 1900s came around, there were 12 left in a zoo. Second World War, the Germans slaughtered, I guess, to the best of their awareness, 600 buffalo in Poland, believe it or not. The bison actually had been, migrating throughout Europe. It had been there for a long, long time. But human beings, just for the joy of killing something, and or using the meat, that's what they did. So there were 12 bison left, and they were in zoos. Now, in England, they decided there were two very, very special organizations that came together. They were able to secure an area of land, and it was all fenced in. They wanted to see what would happen because this forest was dying. There were not the insects there. There were not the animals there. The trees were not healthy, and there was human management that had been done, but it wasn't doing well. Somewhere along the line, they said, we're going to reintroduce the bison. Well, there was a breeding program that went on with those that were in the zoos, and they were able to take, I believe, it was either 4 or 5 of the bison, and they were all females, and they released them. They didn't do anything to support the animals other than to make sure, because they were all tagged, and they wanted to make sure that they were in good health. They monitored them in that way, but they did not feed them. They didn't do anything. They just let them out into this forest that was dying. And what occurred, and the documentation that went on, because they monitored these animals very, very carefully. The first thing these females did, the matriarch, there was a rhododendron, very large rhody. She tears that up, tears it out. The other females that were with her started digging up the ground that was around them. They were astonished at how, within a very short period of time, these females had even stripped bark off of certain trees. And these were long vertical strips. Now, these were animals that had been raised into captivity. When they were following these animals instinctively knew what to do to survive. And they were digging shallow areas where they could roll in the dirt. They would roll in the dirt, and it created these shallow indentations. And when it would rain, water would secure in there. They cleared away debris. They made their own paths. The trees whose bark they had stripped off of ended up dying. But what that did, that fell to the earth, and it opened up canopy areas where other forms of plants could come in. It was within 1 year, the change in that forest started coming back to life. They found within a very short time after the females had arrived, they also brought in a bull. And it was just amazing to watch this program and to find out that when the bison excreted their own dung, bingo, all of a sudden the dung beetle, which hadn't been seen for I don't know how long, it was there. They said, how did it know? How did it know that the buffalo had come in and where to go? And dung beetles are very, very important in the natural environment. Well, it wasn't just the dung beetles. There were all kinds of different activities that started happening. And they said when they were doing this, it was so amazing to see how quickly the forest was coming back to life. And they found out that those trees that were dead, they're called snags. And they said over 2,000 species of life depend on those snags, and one of them is a woodpecker. They will peck a hole in the trunk of the tree, and that's where they will raise their young. This documentary was absolutely fascinating. The first calf born in that wild forest was in 2022, and then in 2023, there was another one. 2024 was another one. It was absolutely incredible. And when I found out about this, I just thought, boy, this is something we really need to know more about. And it's exciting to me because here we are as human beings and we are making a difference. It's happening in Spain. It's happening here in the United States. It's happening in South America. It's happening in Australia. It is happening around the world, Africa. We are waking up to the awareness that we can have this side-by-side relationship with nature. We just need to grow in to a new level of learning and understanding and letting go of old biases of fear that existed. So it's a whole new evolution that is coming about. Well, I know we're just about out of time, and I want to say, before I say goodbye, I want to say that be aware that where you are, who you are, makes a difference. Don't close your mind. If it's through music and dance, like my guest this evening, that's wonderful. But be aware, for every negative thing that you're hearing, there are 1,000 other good things that people are doing. And when we work together, and when we support each other in the best way that we possibly can, when we're willing to educate ourselves, it can make such a difference in our life and in the way that we go about living our lives. And each of us can make a difference, but it's up to us to make that decision and to be alert and to be aware. It's not that I'm Pollyannish. I'm not, because I've seen the dark sides of life in many different expressions. But I know that the way to dispense with that dark side is to bring in the light of knowledge, education, understanding, compassion, kindness, and an awareness that we're the masters of our fate, the captains of our souls. That's right. Take care. Have a beautiful weekend. I'll be back with you same time, same place on Monday. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.